me, it's the Millennial Paul Friends, welcoming you to Star from the Universe On Call. And tonight, well, you got me. You got Gary. How you doing, Gary?
Hello.
Okay. For a moment there, I thought I lost you, which got me concerned. And also, we have Doug, but I'm going to leave him mute because he was helping his wife unload the car at the moment. So I'm going to give him just a few minutes before I bring him in. But yeah, no Jeff this week. Jeff, I think, is having internet issues because of where he's currently located, because he was supposed to play his game against Peter Bakia, and they had to reschedule till next week. But in any case, don't mind me, I'm doing my normal. Let's get things settled in for Twitch on the iPad so I can keep an idea, so I know what I'm actually streaming, so that people know what it looks like. But anyhow, there's to start off with the first topic for tonight. It's actually going to be a quick, and I do mean quick, because it wasn't that of an exciting match against Josh. But, you know, I won. Spoiler alert. A little late. I was supposed to stay that first, aren't I? Oh, well. But anyway, yeah, I won. He did something which I did not expect him to do, which is fine. He launched his shuttle for the launched the scatter pack, and then he did a corner dodge, not full corner dodge. He went like halfway to his closest corner and then turned in. So his drones launched and were coming at me. Launched in when by the time I because I went oh and straight across the map towards the center, and so I slipped toward him. Then his drones launched, and so they launched in two different directions because of I wasn't center line on the scatter pack, and that's good. And so we didn't engage for the first turn. I'm thinking. No, actually, we got to. I'm pretty sure that we got to engage for the first turn. I fired at range 5. Unfortunately, I fired at his. Yeah, it was the first turn. Yeah, I fired at his number 2 shield, which he used instead of putting any power into his disruptors. He put power into a brick on number 2. So obviously. What I should have done instead of taking it at range 5 at number 2, I could have gone to range 6 at his number 3. And that would have been a better result. Now, the good thing about hitting his range 2 on, range 5 was number 2. Yes, I damaged his shield. You know, he put a lot of reinforcement into it. But I was able to, knocked down, a good bit of the shield. He had like 6 boxes left after all said and done. And at that point, I did not displace because I was out of his firing arc for disruptor. So I was like, I'm just gonna go around. But I kept going so that he was to a speed he couldn't turn. So he kept going. He did not hit to set up for next turn. So I kept on going back behind him, and we end up on the next turn just go in loops. He went fast, went slow, and then came up fast. And the problem is when he went fast is that I was able to keep inside him at a slower speed, speed 28. He was going speed 31, I was going speed 28. I had turn mode of 5, he had turn mode of 6, and so I was able to actually turn inside him. So what ended up happening is that on turn 3, I'm coming around. I slow down for a bit so I can actually turn in at speed 15, and I was able to actually get into shield, hit shield number two again, range five. It was range five. He did not fire at me at range five. I'm not sure why not, but he didn't. I knocked him the same shield, you know, that had six boxes, and at that point he conceded. So it was a pretty fast game. You know, in my mind, I'm not sure why he conceded at that point, but he wanted to concede. So I'm not going to get the horse in the mouth. He wants to give it to me, I'll give it. I'll take it. Because of, obviously, even if he even had no reinforcement, which would be my guess, I'm not sure if he was going to use any of the reserve power he had to reinforce, but that was going to be like 20 internals. Was it 20? Yeah, because I got 30. I hit him for 38. So that would have been 32. So it would have been like 20, around 27 internals, which is, you still got a viable ship at that point. But I think basically he just was dejected at that point. That's the only thing I can think of. He just felt like he was out. Felt like he was outmatched, and he conceded. That's the gist. That's the feeling I got. He's not saying that. He just, you know, conceded, and I said, "I'm not gonna leave a gift horse in the mouth." The problem is now it's on round two. Round two, I'm supposed to fight either David Zimbars in the Zinni, and he actually has taught a tactics seminar at a Council of Five Nations many years ago, which I attended. I think I attended that one. Yeah, I did. I did attend that one. That was when I went and I actually attended the Council of Five Nations and played in the tournament up there, which was fun. Or Stephen McCann. Again, we got both of them. These are multi-rated aces, and against me, single. I got a single rated ace, which is so long ago, far away, that doesn't count. And we got the David Zimbars is flying in the Zinti, and we got Moose. Steve McCann, he's flying in the phaser boat of the Wax. That is, he's got the three phaser ones and one the phaser G. So, I'd rather face the Wax than the Zinti. Though in some cases, I'd rather face the Zinti because Zinti is going to go slower than the Wax. But at least with the Wax, you know, then I've got a good chance of I can outmaneuver him. But the problem with he's still got a lot of drones, and he got with all those drones, you know, he can easily, if I try to stay behind him or anything like that, which is kind of almost silly, he can just launch drones at me, and I'll be knocking him down constantly and draining power. And of course, he's going to know that. If he knows that, then he's going to kill me, because at some point my batteries will be drained and he could possibly tractor me, which is an awful thing for the Andromedan. So, you know, that's just a quick
update. This
one's a trunk.
Doug, you're unmuted now. Just to let you know.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you.
Yay. Where does this go?
That's just fly to the tent.
It's going to storage?
It's going to go wherever the tent goes. The tent's going to storage. It's going to storage.
Okay, I'll just throw it in the back.
Okay, put it in the floor.
So,
is all the rest of that stuff standing?
That's a quick review for my Sapphire Star game. Okay. Uh-huh. I'll meet you for another five. Seems like Doug is still busy unpacking the car. Which is fine. I'll bring him back in another 5 minutes. So anyhow, so that's the quick update on Sapphire Star Tournament for when it comes to my game. And we got 5 games completed at Sapphire Star Tournament. Unfortunately, I'm one of those people that's still waiting for their opponents for round 2, which is like, God, I really wish that was completed. Of course, the thing is, I've not heard anything from them, which is fine. They don't have to post thing on the discussion board. I'm hoping that they know that. I hope they've been monitoring the discussion board, because I don't think anyone sent them out an email saying, okay, your game's on. I don't think, because I know I didn't get anything from Steve Petrick. Might have to do that just to make sure that they know that they're supposed to be playing. I have to wait and see. I don't think I've seen either one post anything when it comes to the tournament. But anyhow, with that, we're going to move onward and forward to the main topic for this evening, which was supposed to be the main topic for last week, but as we found out, we were discussing Klingons versus Andromedans. Well, that went out. That went really well, getting past that subject. We never did, which is fine, because of when it comes to, if we were to discuss tactics at all, and I don't plan on discussing tactics this week, probably discussing next week. The one I would want to discuss at all would be the Win Aux box against an Andromedan, because of obviously there are multiple ways of doing it. I still remember the one time I was facing the Win Aux box. And the person basically, what I did is I did something which he feared. I came into range 3. And after getting to range 3, I hopped. I did a diz dev right over him. So I was range 3, but he was behind me then. And he figured the only way he was going to actually be able to win the game was he needed to hit. So he could chase me, which I'm not saying it was completely wrong. The one thing that he would have to have, there's only one thing that if he did that, in theory, I could have headed. You know, if he would, he failed, but if he was successfully headed to chase me, I could have headed not, you know, back. He'd have to go straight. I can go back behind him again by heading. So I'm not sure that tactics was exactly sound in that category. But anyhow, getting to actually to the main topic for this evening. The main topic for this evening is the what if scenario. What if the Tholians, instead of landing in the Alpha Octant, the right there on the outer rim of the Alpha Octant, because they landed in the Omega. Now, I feel pretty confident in saying this, and that is that I don't think that as the Tholians approach the galactic rim, you know, the galactic barrier. Yeah, the barrier. That's it. That they actually were scouting out along the barrier before they actually took the dive into the barrier and got through it. I'm not sure if they had time to do that. I'm not sure even if that would have been of any benefit to them, because I'm not sure if they could actually tell, you know, from outside the barrier what they could actually see if from inside, even if they could. Most of our assumptions are that they dove in wherever was the closest to their galaxy. And, you know, at least that's my assumption at the moment. So anyhow, Doug, you ready?
Yeah, relatively speaking. I'm done moving stuff.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Cool. So anyway, Gary posted this quizzical question at on the discussion board and got a few responses. Obviously, the one thing that was also brought up in this was that, of course, the Seltorians. You know, what would happen with the Seltorians, with the Tholians? If the Tholians had come in the Omega Octant, what would happen to the Seltorians? And I think Gary postulated three or two, Gary, you remember, scenarios?
So, okay, so before I go on, I should point out that the overall idea was that, now, it hasn't been entirely ruled out that even in the historical timeline that no Seltorians or Tholians ever showed up. So, I mean, prior to the very end of the timeline, I guess. So, in theory, there could, in fact, be, like, maybe a Seltorian nest ship instead of a hive ship showed up in Omega. And it's just the story of it hasn't been told yet, because there's a lot of unexplored space and things that, you know, still need to be revised out of the data tapes, whatever. So that what I was suggesting is that in the same way that products like Module R4 or J have multiple timeline options,
mm-hmm.
Someone could do a similar set of timelines, offering these slices of reality, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them could be closer to the real timeline than others. But so far as the big what if went, I had two ideas in mind. Now, others might have different ones. But in order to explain those two ones, then I don't know if your viewers can see the Y100 hex map on
yes.
the screen. Do you have that up yet or not?
Yes, I got that up.
Okay. So, all right. So, in order for us, before we go any further again, I should also note that according to the material that's in the Tholian Master Starship book, at least it should be in there, or at the very least, it's in some of the Tholian material, I think in Away Team Log, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
The Tholians were careless when it came to crossing the barrier, because in the home galaxy, there's a galactic barrier, but it's relatively weak. So crossing it's not that big of a concern. So the Tholians didn't stop to think maybe the Milky Way galaxy's barrier is going to be thicker, and they only found out the hard way. So in retrospect, what they should have done is detach one or two of their ships and try to send them in first. And then once they got feedback as to how tough the barrier was, then they should have tried to account for that, but they didn't. So they learned the hard way that it was much worse, and that's basically the root cause of many of their problems. But so in this case, the assumption would be that it was the same thing. They basically tried barreling through the galactic barrier, but it would be somewhere in Omega instead. But now you could have any sort of timelines where this happens, based on where on the map they'd arrive. But in order to make a viable timeline, you have to be more careful, because if you look on the map, you'll notice that it close to the center of the bottom of the map, there's the L'Oreal home stars. So the L'Oreal are they're generally quite xenophobic in terms of protecting their home territory. So if the Tholians showed up there, they'd be toast. And
right.
That would be the end of the timeline, basically. The end of that scenario. So the better option would be to look at a timeline where they end up either to the west of the L'Oreal or to the east. Now, on the west, in the Y100 map, there's two empires that are on the galactic rim, but there's a little small pocket of unoccupied space between them. So one option could be to have the Tholians arrive in that pocket. Now, if you rewind the timeline back to maybe Y-79, maybe that pocket of unopened space, unoccupied space is bigger because the empires on the rim, maybe they're expanding relatively slowly in that direction by that time. So the map could look a little bit different by Y-100, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Or, but the other option is to look at the big, vast area of unoccupied space to the east of L'Oreal territory. So there's like thousands of parsecs worth of space. And most of that space is not occupied by anybody until the Andromedans and Soldier invasions of the Y-190s. So that's a lot more open territory for the Tholians, or, and by extension, the Sultorians, to show up and park their space, park themselves in. So, long story short, I was basically thinking that you could do up like a... Yeah, can you hear me?
Just pause for just one moment. I just want to point out one thing for those people who don't know, and that is that I'm bringing up the galactic map to show them where the Omega Octant, the Omega map, is versus the Alpha. This is the normal, this is where the Alpha is, where we normally have, where you have the Federation, you have the Klingons, you have all of them. And the Tholians ended up somewhere around here on that map. And we're supposing that instead of ending on this side of the void that separates Alpha and Omega, that they ended up on to the right of that into this Omega area instead. So this lets people know where they are in respect to where they actually landed. So I just wanted to bring that up so people had an idea of where this, where the Alpha is in respect to the normal Alpha map, which everyone knows, anyone who knows Starfleet battles knows that map pretty well, at least the general outlook of what the map looks like. So, continue.
Yeah, so now, if we start with the Western version of the map, then the guys, that pocket of space I mentioned, mm-hmm. on one side, on the right-hand side of the pocket, are the Chlorophons. They're basically, they're a species of trees that have a symbiotic relationship with these aardvark-like people called the Keepers.
Mm-hmm.
So the Chlorophons, there's only so many of them because basically their ships are designed to fit a single Chlorophon at a time, and the crew of Keepers to maintain, to balance the ecology and to be the, you know, the boarding parties and all that kind of stuff. So there's only so many Chlorophons who are physically the right size to fit in a ship. And there's only so many of those who actually want to be in space in the first place, because most of them like prefer to stay on their planets or to maybe be settled onto a new planet.
Right.
So the number of Chlorophon ships is relatively low. And that's another reason why they're not a particularly hostile, like they're not an expansionist power, if that makes sense. So they'll defend their territory if they have to, but they're not necessarily going around conquering people.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as the Tholians keep their noses clean, so to speak, and the Chlorophons won't bother them. But on the flip side, in the bottom left corner of the Y-100 map are the Sigvirians. Now, the Sigs are, they're actually a species, a virus species, that infects carbon-based life forms and assimilates them to become hosts. And so they control a number of various species that they used in order to like fly their ships and, you know, be boarding parties and infect other species and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So historically, the Sigs have been kept at bay, so to speak, because they can't infect the Chlorophons. They can infect the Keepers, but the Keepers can't survive for long without drinking the tree sap from the Fons. And as soon as they drink the sap, the Fon would know right away that the Keeper is infected and then have it destroyed. So they can't basically infiltrate Fon society. So, but that doesn't, I guess that wouldn't stop them trying.
But right. Oh, agreed. But and my understanding, Gary, my understanding when it comes to Singvarians is that they actually had a native host that they had infected and they controlled. And then people didn't realize that the intelligence was not in the host. That was in the virus that was in the host until they actually had like first contact where they went and they were killing all the viruses, you know, in the host because that's normal standard procedure, and it killed the hosts because the viruses were gone, the sick variants were gone. So that's my understanding, correct?
Well, that's what happened back in the home system, but by the time they were in space as an empire, most of their neighbors had figured out who they were. So like the Prober, for example, they're like a little bit to the core word of the Sig territory. They were inoculated themselves against the virus to try to keep the Sigs at bay. But the ones who were caught out were the Kixa. Like there's like a little one hex piece of territory.
Mm-hmm.
They would end up basically being attacked by the Sigs, and most of their people would be taken over. So the refugees would flee into proper space. So if anything, that was really the big thing the Sigs were focusing on in that time period. But from the Tholian perspective, because the Tholians are naturally immune, because the Sigs can't infect a Tholian, the Sigs might see the Tholians as more of a threat. And so it's possible that the Sigs might have taken exception to the Tholians arriving. The Tholians might have basically been obliged to focus most of their forces, such as they were, on that border. But the flip side is that the Tholians, because if you think about it, in the historical version of the timeline, when the Tholians arrived in Klingon space, they had their ships with them, and they could produce more patrol corvettes.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have any of their bases knowledge. Like they had built star bases back in the home galaxy, but all of that knowledge had been lost. So they basically had to start over. So they started over by scanning the wreckage of Klingon bases and then reverse engineering them. Mm-hmm. But in Omega, they wouldn't know that because they'd have to basically learn about the local bases and try to adapt from that. But we don't really know much about what the bases are like. But in any, the assumption is that many of the empires don't build bases as powerful as the standard Alpha thing because they don't think about base warfare the same way. So defensively speaking, it would be a significant challenge to try to figure out that. Because like when people look at an Alpha Tholian setup, like the wedding cake or buzzsaw or whatever, that might not necessarily apply in Omega because the underlying basis stuff wouldn't be there, or would be different. So it would take some thinking in terms of trying to figure out what kind of bases would be appropriate to give the Tholians. In any case,
and the thing is, only... and Gary, the one thing you bring up an excellent point, which is in the Omega Octant, the borders are very fluid, and therefore bases aren't really, from my understanding, aren't really a thing that they really focus on in the Omega Octant. Am I got that right? Do I have that right?
There's only a handful of empires, like the Drex, for example, the space robots. They're really fanatical about building bases.
Okay.
Most of the other empires, yes, they build them more kind of, they're more fluid, I guess you could say, in terms of like where they build the bases and how strong the bases are and what the purpose of them is.
Understood. Okay, that's and the thing is, Tholians, because of, it's not like they can really move around their the Dyson sphere, you know, that easily from point to point. You know, they're more willing or more akin to having static defenses and having a static border. Versus, and I'm just pointing out that it's quite a difference between them and most of the different empires within the Omega Octant, which have very fluid borders over the years. Well, the Tholians wouldn't. That's not their mindset. Their mindset is, you know, set up the borders, protect them fiercely against all attack, because, you know, they're very defensive in nature. It's understandable given that they survived almost complete obliteration by the Saltorians. So,
I got a couple thoughts for you, if you want a couple quick thoughts.
Yeah.
So as far as the basis thing goes, it might be a matter of just form follows function. You know, they might figure out how to do it and just build them anyways. But you could also potentially say, if I remember correctly from way back in the day, didn't they have like ground-based defense module type things that you could have, say, are sitting on an asteroid, and they had so many boxes, and you could have like fighter bases and PF bays and stuff like that. They might, instead of building a huge base like they do in the Holdfast, they might build a series of those on asteroids and still use their web technology to protect themselves. You know, just kind of like asteroid colony type of thing, instead of necessarily big standard SFB base that you see in the main galaxy. Another thought that just kind of crossed my mind was, if they're a group that just accidentally landed there, it's almost like you could throw a dart in there. And once they're in, given that it's, you know, a 3D space and very fluid from what you're saying, as far as not being blocked necessarily from travel, they could probably go anywhere that they wanted to and explore the thing and then figure out where they want to sit down. And they probably keep their heads down very much so, more so than their compatriots next to the Klingons and the Romulans. But they would probably find a little out of the way place that's hard to get to. You know, they might even find a spot in the wasteland that's good for them and nobody else would care to bother visiting. And yet one other thought was, for an interesting scenario or campaign setup, would be that once the Saltorians become a known thing, it's entirely possible that the Tholians in the main area would say, hey, let's send a convoy or two into different directions to get away from these guys, since they're coming for us here. If we can't hold them off, we want to have somebody survive. And you might see them build, you know, not necessarily a big colony ship, but more of a colony convoy with existing ships, throw together some, you know, mobile bases and whatever they can chuck in there. And that could be a group that goes into the Omega and looks for a place to hunker down. And that would be a good thing for them. You know, their convoy could include survey ships, a couple survey ships, scout ships, you know, some small, but not like necessarily a huge dreadnought fleet, you know, a bunch of small ships, and, you know, trying to be kind of semi-stealthy at the same time. But, you know, small ships and freighters, and freighters that don't make it are resources they can't use. That was just kind of a thought that came in, a few thoughts that came to mind listening to you guys and looking at doing that. Mm-hmm. So, there you go.
Understood. I know that without the Klingons, that the Tholians wouldn't have disruptors, and that was actually pointed out by Gary in the initial post. Gary, I'm not sure if I forget, and I apologize. I forget if you thought of, okay, what happens instead of them being on to the, west, left of L'Oreal, but they were to the east, where there was plenty of open space. The only thing was that you had the singers there. you know.
Well, I would move them further away from the singers, I guess. Maybe closer to the there's like a dot to represent the Jindarian Freehold. Mm-hmm. So, but I would basically keep the Tholians well away from anyone else for a while. When it comes to the... Now, actually, one other thing I should mention before we get into the weapon thing is the economics. Because, okay, so in Federation and Empire, between the core rules in the basic set and the rule book for FNE Minor Empires, we have a good sense of what the Tholians and the Sultorians have or what they bring with them or what they can create. So, for example, if you look at the number of economic points that the Tholian sphere creates in FNE, that is actually, in a sense, it's subsuming the number of EPs from the Klingon colonies that are in that hex. So if the Klingons ever defeat the Tholians, they actually basically reveal those three planets and get the economic points from them directly.
Mm-hmm.
So the real output from the Tholian sphere is actually much lower, minus the tribute they're claiming from those colony planets. So what that means is that in Omega, if they arrive in an area of space where there's no major colonies or no major empires nearby, they don't get that economic points. They have to basically establish more of their own mining colonies and other things and stuff. So they're going to be in a much weirder place in terms of the economic side of things. But on the flip side, the Sultorians, they, because of how quickly they can produce workers, and because of the infrastructure they bring with them with the hive ship or an S ship, they just need any semi-habitable planet to beam or to land workers on and start extracting resources, and then they can get their economy up and running. So they're actually probably in a better position to be able to really get things moving if they do find an empty piece of space that they can try to start building an empire in. So. Right. Especially because they bring a prefabricated shipyard with them, and the longer they have with the shipyard operational, the more resources that they can assign to building a bigger yard that can build dreadnoughts. So they never managed to do it in the historical timeline because the ISC stopped them. But in another place like Omega or then the Magellanic Cloud, it's not entirely impossible that they would have enough time to be able to really get going as an empire. And that would be a scary thing. So the Sultorians are basically the ones to really watch out for in terms of how imbalancing they might be on the campaign level. But anyway, the point you were about the weapons. Now, I was trying to cover this on the BBS, so right. I'm happy to hear any thoughts about it. Okay, so in Omega, there's three main source empires, or source factions, I guess you could say, in terms of where you get the weapons from. And option one is from an empire that's relatively close by, that you can do what the Tholians did to the Klingons in terms of launching a border raid to steal the technology. And
Gary, before we go on that,
yeah.
One quick thing, just to mention to people in that, when the Tholians first came, they lost their last copy of basically the particle cannons. And they had no way of creating new particle cannons, correct?
So what happened is the sphere had these data banks. One data bank was marked how to produce webcasters. And the other data bank was titled how to produce particle cannons. But because the crew who were still alive on the sphere, they weren't naval officers. They were police officers, or they were civilians. So nobody, until the Neo-Tholians arrived a century later, no one actually had the codes to unlock these files.
Okay.
So they started by trying to hack the particle cannon files, and it failed catastrophically so that the server basically literally melted down. So they did lose it forever. And then at that point, they decided, we're not going to mess with the webcaster files. They waited until the late Y-170s or whatever. And then once the admiral in charge of the NEO task force, the 312th, showed up, he entered in his codes, and then they worked. So I'm assuming that the same sort of thing would happen in Omega, where the ships, like the NEO frigates and destroyers that arrived with the Sphere, would have their particle cannons functioning. But once the last of those ships is lost, then the Solians have to start fishing around.
Okay. I just want to point out that that's the reason why they need to look for other weapons to add on to the ships, other than what was the particle cannons before that time. They have the technology for the phasers, but not they don't know how to build particle cannons. So they need a heavier weapon to augment the firepower that they currently had with just the phasers.
So on the Western scenario, it's worth noting that a few years after Y-100, the Mesrons barrel in and take over the Chlorophons and also exterminate the Sigvirians, because once the Mesrons realize that they're vulnerable to being infected, they decide that they're not going to stand for that. So they actually bombard the Sigvirian planets and irradiate them, like basically sterilize them. And but that also means that the Mesrons in that region, they're basically at the very end of their logistics, because they're basically spread across most of the Octant by then. And that's one of the reasons why the collapse was so serious later on, because they were spread too thin. But it also means that the Mesrons provide a new option for the Western Tholians to grab a heavy weapon in the form of a Tachyon gun. Before the Mesrons arrive, Sigvirian weapons are unique to that empire. They can't be reverse engineered. Not even those Osborne Marauders can have them. And the Chlorophons have two weapon types or systems. One of them is unique to them. It can't be used by those Osmonds either. But the other one that they have is called the Energy Howitzer. So it's kind of like a shield cracker that hits three shield facings at once. So ironically enough, it wouldn't be that far removed from what the Tholians had given the Saltorians back in the home galaxy. But for that same reason, it's questionable as to how effective a weapon it is for the Tholians to use. Now, that's not to say that they wouldn't find it useful, but whether it would be a high priority for them is another story. Whereas on the other hand, a weapon like a Tachyon gun is much more flexible. Now, it is a two-turn army weapon, so it'd be almost like in the historical timeline, the Tholians eventually get a few photon torpedoes from the Feds. So it'd be almost like reversing the ratio, in the sense that the Tholians would be in the western part of Omega would be more photon Tholian-like than disruptor Tholian-like, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of like your planning for your army and so on, although they wouldn't need to worry about war power, because Tachyon guns can be armed from any power source.
Mm.
So on the eastern side, many of the empires that eventually show up in that region are also incompatible with other empires, because, like, for example, the Alunda, they have the living ships, and biotechnology is not transmissible. But the Kolagar, they're the jellyfish. Their heavy weaponry is compatible, like, with the Zosmans and others and stuff. So in theory, the Tholians could steal the antimatter cannon, which it's a 32 impulse army weapon. So technically, it could be fired every turn, but you have to have that 32 impulse delay. And it does require a certain amount of warp power as well. So it would certainly be an interesting one for the Tholians to consider. Because they do have amount of warp power spare, because that's actually one thing that's worth noting as well. The smaller Tholian ships would be no faster than the frigates that the Omega Empires that they run into have. But when the Tholians start welding them together to build cruisers, they wouldn't have the same firepower as an Omega cruiser of that era, but they would be faster, because most Omega Empires in the middle years, so to speak, they can't go faster than speed 26. So the Tholians would have a bit of an advantage there, not least in terms of having spare war power to arm those kind of weapons. But another alternative, rather than basically looking at a rival, a nearby empire, and stealing the technology from them, an option would be for them to buy or otherwise acquire the technology from one of the mercenary factions in Omega. Because in Alpha, like if you look at the Alpha Octant, the only real mercenary faction that's at large would be the Orion Pirates. And for generally, it's the Orions who are stealing the weapons from the local empires.
Right.
But historically, the Orions never really operated in Tholian space. The Tholians hate piracy. Like, they even hated it back in the home galaxy with the, you know, the OGRs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pathologically incapable of, like, dealing with it. Like, I'm even sure if they even took on Brian mercenaries. But in Omega, you've got three different factions that would, they're not all necessarily pirates, but
right.
They can be if depending on the circumstance. Because you've got the Belosco, the Iridani, and the Zosma Marauders. So you've got one option where the Tholians basically acquire or steal the technology directly from one of those mercenary factions. Or they pay the mercenary faction to steal it for them from a more distant empire. Like, say, for example, because in Omega, the Vari, the space fighters, and some of the Hivers, the space bees, some of the Hives and most of the Vari use a weapon that's called the particle beam. And basically, it's like a particle cannon. The main difference is that it's a little bit weaker, but you can overload both shots in the same turn. So, and it works on fighters too. So when the Tholians are obliged to build fighters, they can put the particle beams on them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem is that the Vari and Hivers, they're not that close. Like, the closest they come to the galactic edge is the Jindarian freehold territory, the little dot where the Jindarians have a permanent holding. So in theory, what you could say happens is either the Belosco encounter the Tholians and say that they're willing to trade, and maybe that trade will involve smuggling some particle beam technology to the Tholians. Or you could have the Iridani, because when the Iridani travel into the galaxy, most of the time, at least before the Andromedan War, they basically, what would happen is that the king on the home planet, back in their extragalactic cluster, would basically give this knight a quest, and the quest could be really convoluted, like give samples of technology to a new species, or hunt a space dragon, or do XYZ or whatever. It's like, these could be really detailed. And the captain of that ship, is the quest knight, is not allowed to go home until he's fulfilled the terms of the quest. And there actually are quests in, like, have scenarios in the game already that involve giving technology to a new empire. And so this would be handy for two reasons. Because one of those quests involves giving the warb, I believe, the space mushroom people, giving them a template of freighters that are in Captain's Log 20. And so in theory, what you could do is you could say, well, so there's a quest knight, he shows up in the edge of Tholian space and hands over a couple of freighters and says, enjoy. And then that's the term of his quest. He goes back home and inherits his barony or whatever. And alternatively, there could be another quest that says, give the technology to a new species. And that might include some sort of heavy weapon and basically landed onto a planet's surface that they know the Tholians are going to patrol, because I suspect the Tholians will probably just start shooting as soon as they see them. And then as long as the knight knows that the object has been left on this planet, and that the Tholians are going to beam down and recover this technology, then that's good enough for his quest. So one way or another, the Iridani could be basically drafted in to be the excuse as to why the Tholians have whichever weapon is deemed to be most suitable for them in an Omega context.
Mm-hmm.
Especially on the western side of on the eastern side of the map, where the Iridani themselves are coming through the galactic barrier to get into the galaxy in the first place. So they're more likely to encounter the Tholians much earlier in the timeline than any of the on-map empires that are further towards the galactic core.
Yeah, the interesting part, obviously, of this is the Saltorians when they come running. And as was pointed out by you, Gary, which was that the Saltorians, basically, all they need is some planets that where they can actually get resources from. And if especially if they land in open space, i.e. territory which is not claimed by any other empire, they could actually in theory set up their own empire. In the Omega Octant, instead of being basically where they in the Alpha, they actually landed in Klingon space. Klingons, that is their empire. That's part of their space. That's part of their empire. And basically, they want. I'm sure they would have been happy to destroy every single Saltorian that was there. But they saw the good in them actually being around, and then want to attack the Tholians. So it's like, okay, well, we'll give you the some resources there. All you gotta do is you can see the Tholians are here. We know you hate you guys, hate those guys. So here, go attack them. Have fun. Versus the Saltorians, if they landed in open space, i.e. territory which is not claimed by any empire, therefore they could set up their own empire, right there, building it up for for fighting the Tholians. Now the question is, would they do that? Because their goal for existing is to find the Tholians that escaped. And when did the Tholians, sorry, when did the Saltorians arrive?
Well, in the standard timeline, they arrived in around 5182 or so.
Okay.
So what you could actually do is, if you have that the multi-page Omega map I mentioned, if you go to the third page, that should be circa Y183. So that would be roughly around the time that the Saltorians arrived in Alpha historically.
Yep.
Because the three Omega maps should be Y100, Y162, Y183, Y192, and Y210.
Right. And again,
Now, if you look on the
to me, if we were going to say, okay, well, the planets landed in the Alpha in the Omega Octant. Again, this leads to, in my mind, the best place if we want to quote unquote place them anywhere is actually to the east, i.e., right of the L'Oreal's, where even in Y83, it's open space between the Galactic Rim and the Alanda. Alanda Hosts. In which case, given that, one, having the Iridani help the Tholians is a lot, in my mind, a lot more likely because they would know them earlier on. And two, if the Saltorians also landed in the approximately same space, let's say that they follow those number of years later, they found the warp trailer or some other techno babble. That would make sense for them both to be in that space, especially because the Saltorians found out, oh, the Tholians are here, but they're way too strong for us. At that point, they'd have a reason to set up their own empire to build up their strength so they actually are able to fight the Tholians.
Well, I would okay. So I think historically, what it was that The original Tholian sphere got away without being followed. But it was the 312th, the Neo-Tholians, they were the ones who were being followed. So I would assume that in these Omega contingencies, that the 312th arrives as normal. And mm-hmm. so the Omega Tholians get the Neo ships, and they presumably get to build a limited number of webcasters as well.
Mm-hmm.
But a few years later, yes, the Sultorians will show up. So in the Western side, I think one big issue is whether or not any of the neighboring empires would actually destroy the Sultorians on site, or if they would have a reason to welcome them. And I think that the only reason that any of the local empires would have would be if either the Sigvarians have done really well in terms of infecting people, and so the Sigs decide we're going to get rid of any species that we can't take over, or if the I've been curious as to, like, would the Tholians and the Trobriand, because the Trobriand are a silicon-based life form, though they're not the same as the Tholians, but they're also not organic. So would the Tholians and the Trobriand see each other as something akin to kindred species or not? But also, would any of the carbon-based life forms, like the Prober or Mesurons, whatever, would they look at the Tholians and think they're too close to the Trobriand for liking? So that would basically, it's possible that then, if the other empires assume that the Tholians are going to ally with the Trobriand against the Carbonites, then maybe one of the carbon life forms that's at war with the Trobriand, maybe they'll host the Sultorians. And that could be basically kind of de facto push the Tholians on into an alliance with the Trobriand. Or on the other hand, if, as you say, if they end up on the eastern side of the map anyway, then none of the local empires, I should say, is close enough to really cause too much interference, because they've also got their own troubles going on. Because by 1103, the Second Great War is pretty much consuming most of the Octant. So yes, that would basically give the Sultorians more breathing room to try to set things up and running. But the key, though, is that the issue would be kind of almost like the Andromedans, in the sense that, yes, when the Sultorians arrive, they have the shipyard production capacity, and they have the new shipyard they bring with them. So they're basically producing ships from the hype ship and also from the shipyard. But what they don't have are bases. So they'd need to actually stop building ships for long enough to start building, like, bases in order to defend themselves. So they might have to do that, as you say, in order to, like, round themselves up, because if they don't, then all it takes is a couple of dominators or a soldier attack force to basically do what the ISC did in the historical timeline and rush the hype ship. And once the hype ship is gone, then the Sultorians are toast. So it's gonna lead to some pretty tough questions for a Sultorian admiral to answer in terms of deciding how much he's going to hold back from attacking the Tholians to be able to build themselves up to the point where they can attack the Tholians and not get, you know, attacked by one of the random, like the likes of the Andromedans or Soldier in the meantime. Because both Tholians and Sultorians, by my understanding, can be fed on by the Soldier. So, because the Soldier are able to drain life, even if it's not organic life. So they can still feed off Tholians and off Sultorians. So that's bad news for them, because if you look in the Y192 map, a lot of that Oak Blank territory is now Soldier territory.
Right.
So whatever it is that the Tholians and Sultorians do, they have to try to survive long enough to either weather the storm or at least to go down swinging. Because when you think about it, even in Alpha, the Sultorians are only on the map for like 4 or 5 years. But that's mm-hmm. a long enough time for them to be considered a regular Alpha Empire, so to speak. So even if they last a year or two longer than that in Omega, that's still good, because Omega is a very volatile place. Like, most empires are not guaranteed a full shelf life to the end of the timeline. So that's kind of the whole point, is in, like, you're taking the tools that you know that both empires have, and you're applying them to this new region of space, and you're saying, well, have at it, you know. So That's part of the reason why I wanted to bring the topic up and see if anyone thought it was interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, and the thing is, especially given that if we place them, both of them, off to the east, in theory, what we can say is basically the same thing occurs to the Saltorians that happened in the Alpha Octant, which is that they were wiped out, either by the Soldra or the Andromedans that came in. Either one that completely wiped them out, and that maybe, you know, there might be the vestige of, you know, because of the web technology that the Tholians have, assuming that they were able to fight off the Saltorians, the Saltorian Empire that was built up, because that'd be my assumption, is that they built up an empire of some sort, you know, with the resource that would need to be required to actually have a war against the Tholians. Because even before the 312 battle group comes in, they've already built up a small empire to a certain degree by that time. And especially if you're going to the east, you have unclaimed territory. You don't have people fighting you for that territory. So they're going to, basically, the people are going to be leaving you alone for the beginning until you run into someone who says, "Hey, wait a minute, who are you?" You know, but I can see the ending map being that the Tholians have this little vestige, something like maybe the Singers, maybe, you know, that's kind of size of an empire after the soldier come a calling, and the Saltorians get wiped out, you know, so that you have a small little vestige of the Tholians left, and they're able to fight off, you know, any attackers at that point, especially with a smaller territory. In theory, you have less of resource that you need to maintain that to a certain degree. You know, there's always that issue of how big is big enough, you know.
Although there is actually one nightmare scenario that you could toss in, maybe as a third timeline. So let's say that it's the Y-180s and the Saltorians arrive in Omega, but they don't run into the Tholians right away. What if they run into a Sigverian refugee ship? Because the Sigs are basically hiding out in different parts of the Octant, like hoping to pounce. But the local empires they've been maintaining their antivirals so that they try to inoculate themselves so they don't get infected. But the Saltorians won't know that. So they could, maybe what happens is that the first time they cross the barrier, they run into a derelict Sigverian ship, and all it takes is one Sig to start infecting crewmen, and then they could turn around and take over the whole hive ship, and suddenly you've got an entire hive ship full of Sigverian infected Saltorians. And they won't care about the Tholians. They could take that hive ship and drive it anywhere in the Octant they want, and then suddenly they could go into the Rin Nebula if they want to have a relatively secure home territory, or they could go into, you know, some other region of space or whatever, and basically plan what they're going to do going forward that has nothing to do with dealing with the Tholians. So now, and actually, when you think about it, what are Saltorian ships really good for? Boarding other ships, because they've got shield crackers and they've got lots of marines, and they've got weapons that are just powerful enough to drop a shield to get the troops over. So imagine if you're doing that, but you're doing it to infect the crew of the ship you're invading, and then suddenly that crew is part of your empire too. So I think that would actually be a zombie nightmare scenario, where you're basically giving the Sigverians a hive ship and a bunch of Saltorian ships to use, and you're letting them loose on the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. That definitely is an interesting scenario. Of course, to me, the tough part in my mind, being Sigverian, assuming that they don't just, you know, in that scenario, stick with the Saltorians and don't try and infect other hosts. They stick with just the Saltorians, you know, and increase their empire so that basically the Sigvarians are now, the Saltorians are now the Sigvarians, and they really don't care about the, because they basically have subjugated the hosts and the thought processes of those hosts. They're no longer, you know, the Saltorians are no longer so focused on the Tholians anymore. You know, they focus just on the Saltorians and their technology. Because the one thing that I was thinking of is that if they tried to infect other hosts with other empires, for those ships to have other technology, to me that'd be, it's a hard situation to maintain. Because they have all these ships, all these different empires with different technologies, and they're really not going to be compatible, and maintaining those are going to be next to impossible. And if you have one of your ships that all of a sudden starts fighting you, you know that they've been infected by a Sigvarian, in which case they're going to kill it. And then they will again go on a rampage and try to kill all the Saltorians themselves.
Well, so the Sigvarians by this point, they've become very clever because, like for example, during the Second Great War, what they did is, if you look in the middle of the map, there's an area called the Nutian Cluster, and the Nutian Cluster is divided into different clans. Now, one of the clans is, by the time of the Second Great War, has been completely taken over by the Sigs, the Tresca clan. So when the Tresca present themselves initially, they don't reveal that they're Sigvarians. They basically act as if they're still regular Nutians. But once the truth comes out, what they do is that they basically reveal a number of pure Sigvarian ships, so to speak, basically yards that are producing the flying saucer Sig ships. But they're treating themselves more like allied factions than they are a single super faction. So it's like you've basically got like a coalition of Sigvarian run empire, mini empires, rather than one big Sigvarian empire now. And on top of that, there's at least one case where this Belosco mercenary squadron shows up, but it turns out that all the crew are controlled by Sigs. And they're not connected to either of the Tresca or the Sigvarians that are fighting, you know, openly on that side of the Oxus. So in a sense, you could basically be very kind of devious with it in that you could have, like, say, if there's a mercenary ship like a Zosman ship or Iridani or Blasco or whatever, and if you infect the crew, you don't basically have to necessarily try to incorporate that ship into your standard fleet. You could still run it as a quote-unquote mercenary, and you could basically, so to speak, hire it as if the same way that you had hired a Ryan pirate ship in Alpha. And so you're basically... you'd almost have, like, say if it was a campaign with different players, you could have a new player every time you successfully infect a new ship or a new faction or whatever. And so you're almost like a team of Sigvarian human players working together to try to dominate the galaxy. But yes, the Sigs have learned to be much more patient because it takes a long time for the Sigs to develop a new strain or a new mutation that can overwhelm a pre-existing antivirus. So it's relatively rare that they do that. So they know that they have to be cautious in terms of trying to infect a new species, because as you say, if it backfires, the secret is out and then they're in big trouble. So you'll almost basically have like a mask, so to speak, where you as the Sig infected ship have to basically act as if you're not infected until you get to the point where you can overwhelm the local antivirus, and then you can decide whether you want to reveal yourself or not. So that might be complicated, like in a campaign, but it would certainly be fun to consider.
Oh, agreed. Oh, I agree. The whole idea of basically secret agents in each empire is actually quite an interesting idea, because that's what it ends up being, is that you have agents working within those empires, which are native, native hosts, meaning, of that empire, but they're not working for the empire's interests. They're working for the Singvarians' interests. So obviously they have to do that thing very secretly and very cautiously and so forth. But yeah, I think that is definitely an interesting idea, especially in the case of campaigns, and possibly even in history, where these little things happen, a certain captain or admiral gets infected and he takes control and does things that, quote unquote mistakes, that benefit another empire, which in that case, that part of that empire might be actually infected by Sigvarians. It's an interesting idea. I agree.
And one final note, because I guess we're going to be wrapping up soon.
Yes.
Is that if you think about it, that might still be a good excuse for Sigvarian infected Seltorians to at least maintain the pretense of attacking the Tholians, even if they they're not attacking as strongly, but they're still making a show of attacking them, because the Tholians can't be infected. So sooner or later, the Sigvarians are going to have to destroy them anyway. So they still have the same end goal that the Seltorians have, but from a totally different reason.
Right.
They want to get rid of the Tholians because they can't bring them into their civilization. They can't bring them into the infection.
Right.
But they don't have the same fanatical urge to do it right away. They can afford to take their time.
Right. That was one thing I was going to point out, which is the Seltorians that were infected by Sigvarians would not be as fanatical about destroying them. In which case, they might actually, Seltorians might, as being host of the Sigvarians, actually might bend better because of them might be a little more logical in their thinking about and more cautious about doing certain things.
Well, if anyone listening to this has any thoughts about this, please, by all means, pop over to the BBS and post your thoughts, because the more people that think that this is a quasi-decent idea, hopefully the better.
Yep, agreed. And possibly ADB might take it up, or the very least maybe farm it out to get some of the rough ideas worked out, how things would work, and help actually create the product, So anyhow, I think we'll wrap it up there. Gary, it's been a pleasure having you here, and I'm glad I finally got you on to discuss this, because I really wanted to do that, kind of in quote unquote in person, instead of just on the discussion board.
Thank you, and to everybody, have a happy 1st and 4th of July.
Amen. You too. Doug, nice having you around.
Thank you for having me on. Didn't have too much to add there, but there it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fine. You did have some input, which is always appreciated. Okay. You have a good night.
You too. Thanks.
So, have a nice little discussion about what would happen and how would it happen if the Tholians actually came into the Omega Octant instead of the Alpha? Because one thing we did not get into, we did not discuss, which is the possibility that the Seltorians basically never showed up. you know, or possibly, you know, which case they say the 312th, if the 312th entered the alpha octant, possibly they would have been completely obliterated by the Klingons. And then the Sartorians show up, then the Klingons would blow them away again because they were following the 312th. But we did not discuss that possibility, which case it would have been interesting because I think overall, I think that the Tholians kind of needed the 312th overall just to make them even a more viable a force. Because of, especially when it comes to the webcasters, those were really important as a defensive weapon against their opponents. I think it was just, you know, that was needed later on as their became more of a thorn in the side of some of the empires. Well, anyway, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.